right here. This is what I deal with every time I mop this damned floor. This is why I'm upset. You explain this to me. What the hell is this?
Al gawked at the reddish mess for a moment, then stepped forward and put a hand on Carmen's shoulder.
I'll tear this linoleum up, he said. We'll replace it. The landlord'll pay for it. It's just old is all. It runs when it gets wet. We'll replace it, and it won't happen anymore.
He squeezed her shoulder and forced a smile. Carmen looked at him as if she were surprised.
Really?
She asked.
Yeah, sure. No problem. We'll just get rid of the damned linole. It's old, that's all. I mean, think about it. How old is this house?
He gave her another smile, and he almost believed that one.
We'll call Lawson and tell him. Then I'll do it this weekend, he said.
That's all it is, honey, really. She stared at him.
You mean it?
Yeah, sure.
Her shoulder sagged with relief. She leaned toward him, and he embraced her.
What's wrong with the floor, Mommy?
Stephanie asked. Al answered,
It's just old, honey. So when it's mopped, the color comes out of it in the water. Looks
like blood, Michael said, with the dread in his voice.
Yeah, Al laughed. Looks almost like blood.
But what's that smell?
Carmen asked. Al shrugged.
Just the linoleum is all.
He turned to Carmen.
You want me to clean this up, hon? I will.
Would you?
Sure, just let me go to the bathroom first.
He kissed the top of her head and left the dining room, went down the hall, holding his breath all the way and into the bathroom, where he closed the door, locked it, and put a trembling hand to his forehead. His head was suddenly aching, throbbing, and his heart was beating in his throat. His calm was gone. The reassurance he'd shown Carmen was not only gone with it, but had not really existed in the first place. He'd groped desperately for the explanation he'd given Carmen for the floor, and, to his surprise, it had worked. The only problem was that he did not believe it himself.
Dear God,
he breathed tremulously as he slid down the door to a sitting position on the floor.
What's happening?
15. House guests. It was on a Sunday afternoon in June, a couple weeks after the end of the school year, that Carmen got the call from her sister, Megan, in Alabama. Michael and Stephanie were playing outside, and Peter was in the backyard with Al, who was trying to get the barbecue started to make hamburgers. Stephen, of course, was downstairs in his room. Megan had diabetes and had been very ill lately. On top of that, she and her husband were going through a very difficult separation, complete with screaming fights and threats, and the digging up of old offenses which were best spoken of privately in hushed tones, not in front of their two daughters. She was calling to ask if Carmen would mind taking in the girls, Mary and Laura, until the situation improved.
Well, sure, it wouldn't be... Can I call you back in a few minutes? I really should talk to Al first, and I promise to call you right back, okay?
As Carmen hung up, the front door opened and Michael came in looking sweaty and out of breath. He tossed her a wave as he passed the doorway on his way downstairs. Carmen went out to the backyard and told Al about her conversation with Megan.
Yeah? Al said when she was finished. Well, if she needs help with them, sure, it's fine with me. How long does she think?
She didn't say.
Well, he shrugged, that's all right. Yeah, go ahead and tell her to send him.
Thanks, hon.
Carmen went back into the house, picked up the telephone, and was starting to dial her sister's number when she heard,
Mom!
Michael's scream was so piercing that Carmen dropped the receiver.
Come here, Mom! Come here now!
She hurried down the hall to the stairs.
What?
She called as she started down the stairs.
What is it?
Michael stood at the foot of the stairs, pointing into his room, mouth gaping as he hopped lightly up and down, his other arms waving, beckoning Carmen to come quickly.
Hurry! Hurry!
He shouted. Once at the bottom, she stood beside Michael and looked into the room and saw... Nothing. She stared, waiting for something, anything that might explain Michael's behavior. Nothing happened.
Michael, what's wrong with you?
She scolded.
But he was there a second ago. He ran all the way around the room on the shelf. Who was there? Who ran around the room?
As Michael stammered, he pointed into the bedroom, his hand jittering anxiously.
Okay, Michael. Calm down. What is it?
Carmen's voice broke. She realized Michael's behavior was making her very uneasy.
It was a boy, Mom. A little boy. He was black and he was wearing pajamas, Superman pajamas, red and blue, and he ran all the way around the room from that end of the shelf to that end, and then he disappeared. Disappeared where?
His body relaxed then, as if his excitement were suddenly being drained out of him. He turned to her slowly and bowed his head, suddenly, ashamed.
Into the wall, he muttered.
Carmen looked around the room silently for a moment. She didn't know what to say or do. How would she explain this sort of thing to Mary and Laura? What would she tell them? Worse yet, what would they tell their mother when they went back home? She was jarred from her thoughts by the sounds of muffled laughter behind them. She turned to see Stephen standing on the other side of the French doors, which were open a crack. He wore only a pair of undershorts that looked in need of a wash and a pair of headphones, with a cord that stretched to the small stereo by his bed. Apparently he'd drawn something on his chest, a star of some sort with a circle around it. He was laughing at them.
"Did you do something to scare your brother, Stephen?"
Carmen asked angrily. He laughed again.
"I didn't do anything." "Did you see it?"
Michael asked hopefully. Stephen held up his hands, palms out, and took a couple of steps backward, chuckling.
"Hey, no way. I'm not breaking the rule. We're not supposed to talk about it, remember? No ghosts, no voices. Otherwise, we get yelled at."
"Well, if you saw something, I want you to talk about it, Stephen," Carmen insisted.
Another laugh as he shook his head.
"No fucking way."
He reached out and closed the doors, then turned and walked to his bed. Carmen spun away from the door, running a hand through her hair as she hissed, "Damn!" to Michael.
"I'm sorry, hun. I just don't have time for this right now. I've got to call your Aunt Megan."
She headed up the stairs, trying to ignore Michael's sad and heavy sigh. Her thoughts returned quickly to her nieces. The girls would think they were all crazy. Should she warn them first? If they knew about what the kids kept insisting they were seeing, if they knew about the history of the house, would they come? Or would they decide to go stay with someone else for a while? "That's not what you're worried about, and you know it," her inner voice murmured. "You're not worried that they'll think you're crazy or about what they'll tell their mother, are you?" "No, of course not." "So what are you worried about, Carmen?" "What?" As she picked up the telephone, she knew exactly what was worrying her. She was worried that the girls would not be safe in the house. Michael went into Stephen's room and stood by the bed, where Stephen lay listening to his music, eyes closed, head resting in the cradle of his interlocked fingers. The muffled music coming from the headphones sounded like a swarm of tiny insects to Michael. He reached down and shook Stephen's foot. Stephen opened his eyes and stared at Michael, but did not remove the headphones at first.
"You saw it, didn't you?"
Michael asked. Annoyed, Stephen slid the headphones back off his ears.
"What?" "I said you saw it, didn't you? The ghost. That little black boy in the Superman pajamas." "How do you know it was a ghost?"
Stephen asked with a sly smile.
"You don't think it was?"
Michael studied his brother's face, the taunting, knowing expression he wore.
"You know what it was, don't you? You know all about it, don't you?"
Stephen laughed and put the headphones back on, closed his eyes, and began to jerk his foot to the beat of the music. Michael backed away from the bed, slowly, and left Stephen's room, closing the French doors behind him. He didn't feel very good all of a sudden, and went up the stairs slowly, trying not to think about his brother, about whatever it was that Stephen wasn't telling them, whatever it was that Stephen knew. Mary and Laura arrived 3 days later. Al went to the airport, picked them up, and brought them home to one of Carmen's festive meals. Mary was 12 years old. a quiet girl with golden blonde hair and a sweet, fair face. She was 7 the last time Carmen had seen her, and she hardly recognized the girl. Even more startling changes, however, had taken place in 17-year-old Laura. She had grown into a tall and beautiful young woman with a svelte and shapely figure and full dark blonde hair that fell to her shoulders. The girls put their bags in Stephanie's room. For the duration of their stay, Stephanie would sleep in Peter's room, and Peter would share Michael's room. They talked as they ate the big lunch that Carmen had prepared. While Mary was quiet and shy, Laura seldom stopped talking. She was animated and boisterous, and the house rang with her laughter. That laughter would not last. While everyone else was eating and talking upstairs, Stephen was sitting on his bed, legs crossed Indian style, in a pair of cutoffs with a large sketch pad open on his lap. Heavy metal music played over his headphones as he drew on the pad with a black felt-tip pen. The music was terribly loud, even too loud for Stephen, but that was the way he liked it. The way he needed it. He kept it that loud for a reason. The voice had been speaking to him with more and more frequency over the months. It used to frighten him. Now, at the most, it merely unsettled him. Sometimes, as the voice spoke, images appeared in Stephen's mind. Ugly, violent images that haunted him. Gnawed at him until he put them on paper, made crude sketches of the faint images that passed back and forth behind his eyes. The pictures were just as ugly as the things the voice said to him. Bad, evil things. He'd been playing the music on the headphones at deafening levels, hoping that it might drown out the voice. Although now he didn't really care anymore. Only occasionally did he feel a chill as he listened to it, to the things it wanted him to do. After all, what was there to be afraid of? As it had told him at the beginning and many times since, Stephen was hearing the very voice of God. As his pen scratched over the pad, the music made him deaf to the laughing voices upstairs. Until...
Stephen!
It was so sudden and unexpected, so clear through the raucous music that Stephen's hand jerked, pulling the pen over the paper in a jagged line as he lifted his head.
Stephen, they're here,
the voice said. Who? He asked silently in his mind. He'd learned that it was unnecessary to speak out loud to the voice. It could hear his thoughts.
Your cousins. Your lovely cousins. You haven't seen them in a while, so you don't know how lovely they are, but they are, Stephen. So young and smooth-skinned. They would feel so good. Taste so good.
As the singer screamed out of the headphones, backed up by shrieking guitars and thunderous drums, Stephen heard the voice laugh gently, that cold, icy laugh that sounded like wet rocks clacking together.
I think you should go and see your cousins, Stephen,
the voice said. Okay. Stephen set aside the pad and pen, slipped the headphones off, and stood up quickly. He didn't hesitate anymore when the voice told him to do something.
No, no. Not now, Stephen.
He sat down on the bed again, slowly, waiting. The pinched music coming out of the headphones beside him sounded like a recording of a massacre.
Later, the voice said. I'll tell you when. Maybe sometime during the night. If not tonight, some other night.
Stephen? His mother's voice startled him. He hadn't even heard her coming down the stairs or opening the French doors. He jerked his head toward her.
What are you doing? Just drawing? The girls are here. We're having lunch. Just wondered if you wanted to come up and see them and eat with us.
She sounded cautious. She sounded cautious around him a lot these days.
Oh, no, uh-uh.
He lay back on the bed, locked his hands behind his head, and stared at her.
You're not hungry?
Uh-uh. Frowning, she approached his bed and got down on one knee.
Stephen, listen to me,
she said softly, hesitantly, almost as if she were afraid to. She reached out and placed her hand lightly on his.
I'm not sure what's wrong with you. You're not yourself anymore. And I think you know that as well as I do. I keep hoping that, well, that if something's bothering you, you'll come to me and talk about it. But I'm worried that, well, I keep thinking that maybe your illness has come back.
He prompted her, starting to smile. She nodded. Stephen laughed.
Don't worry about that. It's not going to happen.
Then he laughed again.
What do you mean?
My friends aren't going to let it happen.
Her eyes widened slightly as her eyebrows huddled above them.
What friends? Who?
My friends here in the house. Oh, that's right.
He put a hand over his mouth and snickered into his palm.
You don't want me to talk about them. You don't believe in them. But that's okay, Mom. They believe in me, and they won't let me get sick again.
She rose to her feet slowly, her jaws flexing as she clenched and unclenched her teeth. She stared at Stephen as if, before her very eyes, he had been replaced by someone she'd never seen before. For a moment she looked as if she were about to speak, but then her eyes fell on the open sketch pad, on the picture Stephen had been drawing. Stephen's eyes followed hers to the figure on the page. It was a man with a mustache and dark hair, wearing a plaid shirt. A man not unlike Stephen's stepfather, Al. Gouts of black blood gushed from the giant fish hook that pierced the man's neck. Stephen grinned at his mother as she turned to him, slowly, a cold look of shock on her face. Finally, she turned and left the room. Stephen laughed as he listened to her climb the stairs, and he heard the voice laugh with him. 16. Laura. Carmen had been wondering when it would happen. It seemed to happen with everyone, so why not the girls? She just didn't think it would be quite so soon. It was the morning after their arrival. Al had gone to work a few hours ago. Everyone had eaten breakfast, and Laura had helped Carmen with the morning dishes. Mary had settled down in front of the television. She was watching a soap opera that she never missed, and the kids were outside. Carmen and Laura seated themselves at the dining room table with tall glasses of iced tea. They had made small talk as they worked in the kitchen, but Laura had been unusually quiet. Yesterday, Carmen had thought it impossible for the girl to so much as calm down, but she was calm, even frowning a little, as if something was troubling her.
So, how'd you sleep? Carmen asked.
Oh,
Laura shrugged. I know it's hard to sleep in a strange place sometimes. Takes a while to get used to a different bed than your own.
Laura nodded.
After a moment, you didn't sleep well, did you?
Laura's features tightened as she thought a moment.
Aunt Carmen, something's...
She took a deep breath, sighed.
What? I don't like this house.
It was Carmen's turn to sigh. Less than 24 hours had passed, and already...
What don't you like about it?
Well, Mom told me it used to be a...
I wish she hadn't done that.
Oh, that doesn't bother me, really. It's something else. The way I felt last night in bed, like, well, like I wasn't alone in the room.
Mary was with you.
No, that's not what I mean. I felt like there was somebody else there, in the room. Somebody moving around, maybe, in the dark.
And?
Well, there wasn't, of course, but it felt like there was.
Carmen thought before she spoke. She could tell Laura the same thing she'd told Tanya, but why open that can of worms? Even she didn't quite believe that.
Honey, I'm afraid you've walked into a very weird household, Carmen said. At least it's weird at the moment. You know about Stephen's illness, but, well, things have been tense here ever since then.
She told Laura briefly about the changes that had taken place in Stephen since his illness, and their theories as to the cause. His illness, the treatments and medication, the move, and perhaps in part his association with Jason, and the stress his change had put on the entire family. She told Laura of Stephen's feelings about the house, that it was evil, haunted, possessed by someone or something, and how that had affected the other children and frustrated Carmen and Al to the point of anger. She did not, however,
tell Laura of her own experiences in the house, mostly because she was trying to forget about them herself.
"I suspect what you're picking up on," Carmen said, "is the tension in the house. That's all."
"So Stephen thinks the house is haunted too, huh?"
Carmen could not hold back a small flinch.
"Then that's what you think?"
Laura shrugged.
"Well, I'm not sure. But I know I felt something weird last night. And it wasn't tension, Aunt Carmen. It was, well, it felt bad. Dark. It's hard to explain, but to be honest, I don't feel comfortable in here right now."
Carmen closed her eyes a moment and considered her response. A sudden wave of dread passed through her. Having another person in the house who insisted it was haunted would only make things worse.
"I hope, Laura, that you'll keep your feelings about the house to yourself, please. Don't say anything to the kids, and especially, don't say anything to Al. He's sick to death of this. He'd go through the roof."
Laura agreed to say nothing.
"But it still makes me kind of nervous. Being here, I mean.
Just new surroundings, that's all. You'll get settled."
Carmen forced a smile that did not feel, or look, very convincing. 17. Summer into Fall, Part 2. After a while, the girls began to behave as if they were living at home. By the second week of their stay, they were comfortable enough to lounge around in sloppy clothes, or go to the refrigerator and get something whenever they wanted. They became regular members of the family so easily that everyone else quickly forgot that they were really guests. But as comfortable as they became, Laura was never quite able to relax. She always felt as if something deep down inside was bothering her, making her tense and anxious, nervous, and sometimes even a little nauseated. But it wasn't anything deep down inside. Laura knew exactly what was making her feel that way. The house. The worst thing about it was that she couldn't put her finger on precisely what it was that bothered her. It was just a feeling. Sometimes it was a cold feeling, a bone-deep chill that passed over her, through her, then disappeared in a moment's time as she walked down the hall or passed through a doorway. Other times, it was the feeling she was being watched as she undressed or showered. There had been a couple of instances, in fact, when she'd cut her shower short because of the overwhelming, almost smothering feeling that someone was in the bathroom with her and was about to rip the shower curtain aside and laugh at her, though all she had to do was look around to see that she was alone. Sometimes, she felt that she was being followed through the house or, and this was the worst, she felt someone brush by her in a doorway or in the hall, but there was never any evidence that her feelings had merit. There was never anyone nearby to make her feel that, and no matter how hard she looked, she never saw or even heard anything to explain her feelings. At least not yet. As the days and weeks passed, Laura started hearing some strange sounds. Al had brought a small fold-out cot into Stephanie's room, and the girls had flipped a coin to see who got the bed. Laura had won. Sometimes late at night, while Mary was sound asleep, Laura thought she heard footsteps walking slowly around her bed in the dark. They were soft, cautious footsteps that barely tapped against the wood floor as they moved along one side of the bed, around the foot, and up the other side, then back again. The second night it happened, Laura woke her sister.
"Mary! Mary! Wake up, Mary!"
In a moment.
"What's the matter?" "Listen,"
Laura hissed.
"What? Just listen."
Silence.
"Listen to what?"
Mary asked groggily.
"You don't hear anything?" "No. You don't hear, you know, footsteps?" "Oh, come on, get real, Laura. I was asleep."
She rolled over again and ignored her sister. Other times, she thought she heard someone walking around outside. Even though it didn't make sense, she knew it was impossible. Laura thought she could hear someone walking all the way around the house again and again, all night long. Sometimes when she was sitting in a room alone, on the living room sofa reading, for example,
She thought she heard a voice whispering to her unintelligibly from a shadowy corner of the room. After Aunt Carmen's reaction to her first remarks about the house, she was afraid to say anything more to her. And after what Aunt Carmen had said about Uncle Al, she was certainly afraid to mention it to him. So she kept it to herself. She continued to tell herself that it was just her imagination, even though deep down inside, she knew it was not. It wouldn't be long before she realized that she was, indeed, right. Very late one night, when Stephen was deep in a rare, restful sleep, the voice said to him sharply,
"Stephen, it's time to get up, now."
Stephen's eyes snapped wide open, and he sat bolt upright in bed, his back stiff, fists clenched. In spite of the depth of his sleep, in spite of the fact that it had been a while since he'd slept so well, he was awake instantly.
"Get up, Stephen," the voice said. "It's time to go visiting."
Stephen knew immediately what that meant. He swept the covers aside and got out of bed, left his room and crossed Michael's, being very careful to wake neither Michael nor Peter. Once upstairs, he passed through the living room, went down the hall and very, very carefully opened the door to Stephanie's room. Once he was able to stick his head in, he waited for signs that he'd disturbed Laura and Mary from their sleep. When he heard nothing, he entered the room and closed the door silently behind him. Pale, dim moonlight illuminated the room through the window at the far end, and Stephen used it to maneuver himself between the bed and cot. For a long time, he watched them sleep. He turned from one to the other slowly, his eyes caressing their defenseless faces, watching them as they dreamed. An urge built up in him slowly as he looked at them, an urge he could not long ignore. Finally, as he stood there in the moonlit darkness, he gave in. Staring at Laura, who lay on her back leaning to the other side of the bed, he reached down and very carefully placed his hand on her shoulder to see how she would react. Nothing. He lowered his hand to her upper arm. Still nothing. Her slow, rhythmic breathing continued. He moved his hand over to her breast.
"Feels nice, doesn't it?"
the voice asked quietly.
"Wonderful," Stephen thought dreamily. "It feels wonderful."
"You'd like to feel more, wouldn't you? You'd like to do more."
"Yes, I would."
"But she's too big. She'd defend herself. She'd only get you into trouble. You need someone smaller. Someone younger."
"You're right. I don't need that kind of trouble."
"Turn around."
The voice laughed. Stephen turned around as he was told. He looked down at Mary. Smaller. Younger. Definitely unable to defend herself. Stephen smiled, lowering his hand first on the girl's shoulder, then on her arm.
"That's better," the voice whispered.
It was 2 days later when Carmen drove home with a back seat full of groceries to find Laura and Mary on the front porch. Her attention was drawn to Mary in particular. She was sobbing uncontrollably. Carmen pulled into the driveway, killed the engine, and hurried to the porch.
"What's wrong? What's the matter?"
she asked. She hadn't seen the girls this way since they'd come to Connecticut, and her voice sounded frantic. Laura put an arm around Mary.
"Aunt Carm, something terrible's happened. You may not believe it, and if you don't, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself."
Carmen sat down beside Laura and said,
"Just tell me, please. I'll believe you."
It took a while for Laura to get it out, but finally she said,
"Stephen, he molested Mary."
Carmen could only stare at them in numb shock. She knew in her gut, the moment that Laura said it, that it was true. It was even unsurprising. It seemed a natural direction for his behavior over the months to finally take.
"When?"
she asked. Laura said,
"This afternoon, while you were gone. He didn't, get very far, if you know what I mean. I caught him first."
"Okay," Carmen breathed, realizing that she was suddenly, for some reason, out of breath.
Okay, okay, I'll, take care of it. Right now, where is he?
In his room,
Laura said. Of course, Carmen thought as she got up and went into the house. She went downstairs to find Stephen, as usual, sitting on the side of his bed wearing headphones and drawing in his sketchpad. Carmen reached out and plucked the headphones off.
What the hell did you think you were doing?
She asked angrily.
Doing when? Today. With Mary. You know what I'm talking about.
He said nothing. His mouth curled upward into a smile, and he laughed.
Okay. That's it. I mean, that is really it. We've tried so hard. God knows we've tried, but nothing seems to make any difference. You don't change. You just get worse. And this is the last of it, Stephen.
She spun around and left the room, went upstairs and straight to the telephone. Carmen called the police. Stephen was taken away by the police that afternoon. He was questioned, at which time he confessed that he'd been fondling the girls while they slept at night and that he'd attempted unsuccessfully to have sex with his 12-year-old cousin. Then he was delivered to the juvenile detention center, where he was later interviewed by a psychiatrist. In the meantime, Carmen was at home riddled with guilt. Al would be home soon, and she worried that he would be furious. At the same time, she suspected he would be very happy, and that would make her feel even worse. But she had done what she had thought best. They had dealt with the unpleasant changes in Stephen long enough. Obviously, those changes had gone way too far, and something had to be done. This might, at least, get him some help. When Al got home, he wasn't furious, but he wasn't happy either. He simply thought Carmen had done the right thing. He told her that maybe it would turn out for the best, that maybe it was the kick in the pants Stephen needed. As it turned out, Stephen needed more than that. The psychiatrist who had talked with Stephen called Al and Carmen and told them it was his opinion that Stephen was schizophrenic, in other words, drastically out of touch with reality, and was in need of at least a 60-day observation period in an appropriate mental hospital. He suggested Springhaven. He recommended, however, that he spend the night in the juvenile detention center. He didn't think the family would be safe with Stephen in the house overnight. They were devastated. Their son was indeed, just as they had suspected, mentally ill. What had they done wrong? Every parent makes mistakes in raising their children, but what mistakes had they made that would bring their son to this? They wondered how they could have been so callous. All that time he'd spent telling them he was hearing voices and seeing things. They had only gotten angry at him, when his real problem was a serious mental illness that he could neither help nor understand. Their guilt and sadness were weighing heavily on them when, the next day, they picked Stephen up, took him to Springhaven's psychiatric hospital, and admitted him. It was an attractive building with lots of green grass around it, shaded by a number of enormous oak trees. A tall, solid fence stretched all the way around the sprawling grounds, and patients and attendants strolled the grass calmly. Stephen said nothing to them the entire time. He ignored their apologies, their offers of help, their pleas for him to talk to them. He remained silent until the moment they left him at the hospital. Then he looked at them, smiled darkly with expressionless eyes, and said quietly,
"Now that it doesn't have me to talk to, it's going to come after you. All of you."
Al and Carmen left, saddened by his remark, thinking it was nothing more than another of the many symptoms of his illness. Unfortunately for them, their children and Carmen's two nieces, they were wrong. 18. The Ghost Hunters. At a small, modest house in Litchfield, Connecticut, around the time Al and Carmen Snedeker were leaving their oldest son at Springhaven Psychiatric Hospital, a 42-year-old woman named Florence Mack was floating several inches above the chair in which she'd been firmly positioned just a few moments before. Her body, still in a sitting position, was tense, and her face pale with horror as she stared at the others around her. Those people included her 48-year-old husband, Dale, and their 21-year-old daughter, Sophie. With them were a tall, rather regal-looking woman, standing beside a burly, barrel-chested man, both in their early 60s, Lorraine and Ed Warren. For a moment, all four of them watched in shock and horror. Then Ed stepped forward, waved to Dale, and said, "Get her away from there!" As Dale stepped toward his wife to pull her away from the chair, Ed raised his right hand and, in a booming voice that echoed off the walls of the house like the strike of a hammer, he barked, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave these people and go back to the place from which you've come." A framed picture on the wall dropped to the floor. Two rows of porcelain bric-a-brac on a small shelf were swept through the air by an invisible hand and thrown against the next wall, the pieces shattering over the floor and a small dining table. Dale Mack embraced his wife and held her close as he led her across the room. An oak hutch with a glass front and shelves of china inside shook as if the earth were moving beneath it. The four chairs around the dining table abruptly slid away from it simultaneously, as the pane of a nearby window rattled wildly. Ed turned, watching each event as it happened. Lorraine held a small cassette recorder in her right hand. It was recording the sounds of everything that happened around them. As the chaos continued, Ed raised his right hand once again and repeated in the same booming voice, but even louder and more firmly this time, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave these people and go back to the place from which you've come." The rattling and shaking continued for a few seconds. Then the house fell silent. Everyone remained frozen in place for a moment. Then Ed turned, gave the Max a cautious but comforting smile, and said, "I think it's stopped."
"It's only stopped for now," Mr. Max said wearily, his arm still firmly encircling his wife's shoulders. Mr. and Mrs. Warren, when we talked to you on the phone, this is exactly what we were talking about. It's been happening all the time."
Ed turned to Lorraine and asked, "Did you pick up anything?" She placed a hand on her chest and sighed heavily.
"This is definitely an evil spirit, Ed. It's not a poltergeist, like we first thought when we heard their story. It's an evil spirit, and its intentions are malignant and strong."
He nodded toward the recorder. "You getting this?"
She nodded. "It's still on."
Ed moved toward the Max, smiling at their daughter, who was so horrified by what she'd seen that she still stood beside her parents now and away from the area of activity, with her back stiff and both hands pressed over her mouth, eyes wide.
"I'd like to ask you a few questions," he said quietly.
"Why don't we go into the living room? Sit down and try to relax."
Lorraine followed them as they went into the next room and everyone took a seat. She sat beside Ed on the sofa and placed the recorder on the coffee table.
"I think the first thing we need to know is this," Ed said, clasping his big hands together. "Does most of the activity surround you, Mrs. Mack?"
She opened her mouth but couldn't speak. She simply nodded her head. Her husband said,
"Yes, definitely. Always, in fact. It always involves her somehow. She's never been hurt."
They were sitting together in a love seat, and he placed a hand on her knee gently, looked at her, and asked,
"Have you? I mean, not that I've ever known."
She just shook her head and finally spoke in a hoarse voice,
"No, never. Just terrified. It terrifies me."
"Of course it does," Ed said. "It should. But if it hasn't hurt you, we're ahead of the game. I just wanted to know if it pays more attention to you than anyone else. Tell me, does anyone in your family dabble in the occult? Any Ouija boards, tarot cards, demonology, that sort of thing?"
Mrs. Mack shook her head firmly.
"Never. Not in all our years."
Sophie was shaking her head, too, and Ed turned to her questioningly.
"No, I don't live here anymore, but, I mean, I'm an only child, so I should know. I've never played with any of that stuff, and, as far as I know, neither of my parents. I mean, why would they? We've always been a Christian family, and we just don't believe in getting involved in that sort of thing."
"Okay," Ed said, nodding. "That's good. Here's another question, and please, don't think it insulting. It's just something we have to ask in our work, only as a precaution, and I hope you'll answer honestly. Do any of you take drugs or drink heavily?
Oh, no, definitely not, Dale said.
Sophie added,
even when I was younger, I never did any of that.
Ed nodded thoughtfully, then looked at Dale and Florence again.
You've been the only ones living in the house for how long?
Almost 3 years.
Another nod. He turned to Lorraine and asked,
you want to look around?
Well, I can, but it's a very small house. I don't know if I need to. We've already seen quite a lot.
Yeah, we have, that's for sure. Mr. and Mrs. Mack, we're going to get some researchers in here right away to spend some time with you. If it's not an inconvenience, they'll be spending day and night in the house, recording everything that happens. We'll be back within the next couple of days with a video camera to record an extensive interview with you and get all the facts from the very beginning. I mean, we'll get what you've told us already, and more. We want everything, and I mean everything, on the record.
It wouldn't be any inconvenience at all, Dale said.
Good. The next step would be to bring in a member of the clergy. Are you religious people?
Well, we've always been Catholic, but we haven't been practicing Catholics for many years.
But you wouldn't object if we brought in a priest?
Not at all.
Because I suspect we're going to need an exorcism.
Can you tell me something?
Dale asked.
Can you tell me why it's after my wife?
She seems to be the center of it. It always surrounds her. This isn't the first time she's floated like that. We don't understand it.
I honestly don't know. But I suspect that after we've asked you a few more questions, we might have some idea as to why that's happening.
Ed was being diplomatic. He knew from experience that when something like this took place, it was usually for a reason. He suspected that, in spite of what they'd said, they'd been involved in some sort of occult activity. Perhaps Mrs. Mack, on her own and without the knowledge of her husband, had been consulting a Ouija board or a psychic, or had been attending seances to contact some dead relative or friend. But he didn't want to say that now because it had been his experience that such accusations tended to anger people, even if they were true. Sometimes, especially if they were true. They left the Macks with smiles and handshakes, although Mrs. Mack was still so shaken that she remained on the love seat in the living room, cold and silent, and went to a nearby coffee shop to discuss what they'd learned. It was a busy coffee shop with lots of noise around them, and they had to speak louder than usual to be heard.
I think Mike would be best, Lorraine said. I think we should send him. He's had experience with situations like this before, and I think he could handle it.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
He sipped his coffee.
So you think it's an evil spirit, huh?
Positive. And I think it's probably there for a reason.
You mean they brought it on?
She nodded.
Somehow. Since it's focusing on the wife, I suspect it's probably something she's doing. But that's the way it usually is, right?
Even though they don't realize it. Ed nodded, releasing a heavy, weary sigh. They'd both put in a long day, a long week, and they were tired.
You want something to eat?
Ed asked.
Sure, I'm hungry. But remember, no red meat. You're gonna cut back, right?
Yeah. And you're gonna kill me, is what you're gonna do, he murmured.
They picked up the menus and browsed through them in the comfortable silence of a couple who have been married for years. When Ed was 5 years old, his family moved into the top floor of a two-family house on Jane Street in Bridgeport, Connecticut. It was directly across the street from St. John's Church, the church Ed's grandparents attended, and that his family began attending from then on. That house on Jane Street was to start what would be a lifelong interest for Ed Warren, a passionate interest that would lead him into some very strange places and show him some frightening things. At a very young age, that house was to change Ed forever. That house was haunted. On numerous occasions, every member of the family, Ed, his twin sister, his brother, and his parents, saw the apparition of an old woman who always looked less than friendly. Ed's father was a police officer and a stern but sensible man. Not wanting his children to be frightened, he tried to tell them that there had been a logical explanation for what they had been seeing, but they all knew better. Every Sunday, Ed's grandparents joined them for breakfast, and the sound of Grandpa coming up the stairs became very familiar. His labored steps, the thump of his cane, his heavy, wheezing breaths. When Grandpa finally died a number of years later, Grandma was understandably devastated, and Mom frequently checked up on her to make sure he was okay. One day, Mom was gone later than usual, and it wasn't until very late in the evening, when the children were ready for bed, that they heard the door open downstairs. Thinking that Mom had come home, Ed left his bedroom and turned on the light so she wouldn't fall on the stairs. As he started back to his room, he realized it wasn't Mom coming up the stairs at all. He heard shuffling steps, a thumping cane, wheezing breaths. It was Grandpa coming up those steps. Grandpa, who had been gone for some time. Ed heard him go into the kitchen and walk in circles for a while. At about the same time, Lorraine was attending a Catholic school and trying to hide from the nuns, an ability that she had only recently, at the age of 9, discovered she possessed. Lorraine could see colored lights around people. The colors followed the outlines of their bodies. They were very pretty, but Lorraine didn't know what they meant, if anything. The sisters constantly discouraged her from even bringing the colors up in conversation. She was told she had a vivid imagination, that was all. She learned quickly to keep the colors to herself, but that did not keep her from seeing them. There was no one in Lorraine's world to answer her questions about them. It wasn't until much later that Lorraine realized she was seeing the human aura, and that, being clairvoyant, she was able to see and feel many other things that most people couldn't. They met when they were 16. They were drawn together. Lorraine proudly told friends, "Ed is the only man I've ever dated." After they were married, Ed graduated from art school, and, in a 1933 Chevy he had bought for $15, they took to the road selling his paintings here and there. But whenever they heard of a haunted house in the paper or by word of mouth, they would travel there, and Ed would paint the house. Then Lorraine would go to the door with the painting and say, "My husband has sort of made a habit of painting haunted houses, and he's painted yours. We'd like you to have the picture." That almost always got them in the door so they could question the people who lived there, ask about the haunting, and get the story directly from them. Over the years, based on their research, which became more and more extensive as the years passed, Ed and Lorraine began to develop theories about how hauntings worked, about why they took place, about what brought them on. They read countless books on the subject, but, as Lorraine said in the midst of their research, "It sounds like all these guys are reading the same books we're reading." So they did not depend on the regurgitated and incestuous work they read to develop what was to become the New England Society for Psychic Research. They depended only on their own experiences, on the things they had witnessed. As the years passed, books were written about them. Later, movies were made about them. They began to teach classes on what they had learned, turning students into researchers. They traveled the country and lectured at colleges about their experiences and what they had learned from them. Ed had turned an experience in a haunted house as a child into a life's work, and Lorraine had joined him to use a talent that, as a child, had been taken seriously by no one. And now they were in a loud and busy coffee shop in Litchfield, Connecticut, waiting for their orders. Somewhere in the coffee shop, a telephone sent out its electronic chirp. Lorraine scooted away from the table and stood. Ed laughed and said, Hey, what are you doing?" Lorraine stopped, her mouth dropped open, and she pressed a hand to her chest. "Oh, my goodness, I was getting up to answer the phone." She put a hand over her mouth and returned to the table. Ed laughed a deep, resonant laugh, his whole body shaking as he shook his head. "Oh, boy, Lorraine, that's rich. That's good." She laughed, too, and said, "Well, the phone at home is ringing constantly, and it seems every time I turn around I'm getting up to answer it."
Yeah, he laughed. "But a coffee shop? You know what that tells me, Lorraine. You know what that says to me? We need a vacation.
We need a vacation really bad, 'cause we've been working too hard.
Well, we've just taken on another case.
I have a feeling it won't last too long. I mean, it probably won't take much to get the church to sanction an exorcism for this one. What's going on there is pretty obvious. But as soon as this one's over, we take a little vacation. We need a break.
Months would pass before that case came to its close, and a grueling church-sanctioned exorcism was held, thus relieving the Max of the demons that plagued them in their home. But of course, Ed and Lorraine were unaware of the Snedekers and the things that had been taking place in their home. The vacation Ed had said they needed so much would not come for some time. 19. The Darkness Closes In. Al and Carmen Snedeker were saddened by what Stephen had done to his cousin and by his hospitalization, but they assumed that, because he was gone, the atmosphere in the house would improve. It had been so tense and charged with hostility for so long that they were hoping for a relief, a return to some sort of normalcy. They assumed the younger children would be more relaxed without Stephen's stories of ghosts and apparitions, and Laura and Mary would sense that and, as a result, feel more relaxed also. They were wrong. During the following weeks, the small, strange things that had been occurring now and then in the house, the noises, the fleeting glimpses of something darting here and there around a room, the sudden changes in temperature, and the inexplicable feelings of being watched or of simple, heart-clutching dread, would begin to escalate, would grow in severity and frequency until those strange things were no longer small at all. In fact, before Stephen left the house, their troubles had hardly even begun. Whatever presence lurked in the Snedeker's house wasted no time now in making itself known to the rest of the family. The evening after Stephen left, Al was watching television and having a beer, while Peter and Stephanie sat on the floor taking turns on Etch-a-Sketch. Michael was in his room doing homework, and the girls, Laura and Mary, were in the kitchen cleaning up with Carmen. Since the incident with Stephen, Carmen had been making an effort to pay special attention to Mary. She'd made sure Mary wasn't physically hurt, had apologized to the girl profusely, and told her to speak up if she wanted to talk to someone about what had happened. Mary had told her, however, that she didn't want to stay there anymore. Carmen understood perfectly and called her other sister right there in Connecticut and asked if she'd mind keeping Mary for a while. She said it would be fine and she'd pick Mary up in the morning. Everyone went on, doing whatever they were doing, the children giggling quietly on the living room floor so they wouldn't disturb Dad as he watched an old black-and-white war movie, and Carmen and the girls laughed and talked in the kitchen, as water ran in the sink and the dishes clacked together while being washed. Al finished his beer a moment before the movie was interrupted with a set of commercials. He left his chair, went into the kitchen, tossed the empty bottle into the trash, and opened the refrigerator to get another. His hand stopped abruptly on its way to the refrigerator's second shelf as the entire house shook with a powerful, deafening bang. Everyone fell silent and did not move, their bodies frozen in place. It happened again. The window panes trembled, bottles rattled and clanked inside the refrigerator. It happened a third time, and then nothing. Footsteps thumped rapidly up the stairs, and Michael shouted, "Dad! Dad!" In his socks, he skidded to a halt on the kitchen floor. Stephanie followed him, holding Peter's hand, their eyes wide.
"What was that, Dad?"
Michael asked, his voice hoarse.
"I don't know, but I'm sure as hell gonna find out. An earthquake, maybe?"
he asked, turning to Carmen.
"I don't think so. It sounded like an explosion of some kind."
"Yeah, okay. I'm gonna look around."
He started out of the room and turned to Carmen again, pointing at the ceiling with his thumb.
"Are the Van Owens home?"
"No, they're out of town, remember? They were gonna be gone for 3 days. They'll be back tomorrow night."
"So there's nobody up there?"
"It didn't come from up there, Al. It sounded like it came from down here, right here in the house."
"Shit,"
he hissed as he left the room. The others didn't move. They just stayed in place and exchanged fearful, nervous looks. Al went through the entire house, including the basement. He looked out every window. He looked behind every door. He frantically searched each room for damage, even sniffed the air for the smell of smoke or gas or electricity. But he found nothing.
he returned to the kitchen, very puzzled, where everyone was still gathered, a bit more relaxed, but no less confused.
"Did you find anything?"
Carmen asked, nervously, quietly.
"No. No, I didn't find anything."
Al actually felt ashamed to have to say that. The three pounding noises they'd heard were big, not sounds from the neighborhood, but sounds from inside the house. The fact that he was unable to find anything meant it was out of his control, and he knew that everyone was depending on him for an answer. He had none. Far too many things had been happening in the house lately over which he had no control.
"But it was right here," Michael said, "in the house."
The telephone rang.
"I'll get it,"
Carmen said. She went to the living room, dropped onto the sofa, and answered the telephone.
"Hello?
Carmen, it's Tanya."
Carmen leaned forward and brightened.
"Did you hear it?"
"Hear what?"
"The sounds, three of them. Big, pounding sounds, almost like explosions. Did you hear them? Is that why you're—"
"No, I didn't hear anything. I'm calling because—" "Well, I know this is going to sound weird, but I just happened to look out the window and, did you know that there's a very strange-looking woman walking around in the room above you?"
Carmen's mouth dropped open for a moment.
"What?"
"Really, I'm not kidding. I saw her. There's a woman up there, and she's green. And she's glowing. I saw her walking back and forth in front of the window. She looks, upset. Angry, maybe."
Every single strange and frightening thing that had happened over the past year flashed through Carmen's mind, and tears came to her eyes.
"Please, Tanya, please. Tell me you're joking. Tell me this is a joke."
"You think I would call to make a joke like this?"
she asked incredulously.
"No, no, you wouldn't. Hang on, please. Don't hang up."
She put the receiver down and rushed into the kitchen.
"Al, it's Tanya on the phone. She said there's someone walking around upstairs by the window."
He frowned.
"What?"
"Come here a second."
She led him through the dining room, into the hall, and whispered,
"She says it's a green, glowing woman."
He rolled his eyes.
"Carmen, would you please—"
"No, I'm serious. She's not joking, Al. Think about it,"
she hissed.
"What's been happening in this house? We can't explain most of what goes on, can we?"
He thought about that a moment, then shook his head and said,
"No. No, we can't, really."
He reached out, squeezed her hand briefly, and said,
"I'll go outside and look up there, see if I can see her. Because, you know, their door is locked and—"
"Yeah, I know. Go ahead. Get out there."
Al went outside and Carmen went back to the telephone.
"Tanya, Al is going outside now to look."
No, she's gone. I'm at the window right now and I've been watching. She's gone. I don't see her."
"You're kidding. She's gone, really?"
"Yeah, I don't see her. She hasn't been by the window for a while now."
Carmen sighed.
"Okay. I'm gonna go now, Tanya. I'm gonna go out with Al and tell him."
"Wait a second, Carmen. Remember that magazine I showed you? You took it home. It had those people in it, the Warrens, Ed and Lorraine Warren. I really think you should call them, really. You've got something really weird going on over there, and I think you need them."
"Yeah, well, I might think about it. Thanks for calling."
Carmen hung up and hurried outside to join Al. He was standing away from the side of the house, near Tanya's, looking up.
"Tanya said she was gone,"
Carmen said as she approached him.
"What?" "She said the woman was gone. She hadn't seen her in the last few minutes."
"Well, then she was probably seeing things,"
he said angrily.
"Al, you know that's not true. Something really weird is going on in our house."
"Oh, shit, you listened to Stephen too much. He's sick, Carmen. You know that now. He's very sick, and the things he said he saw and heard, those were just symptoms, that's all, nothing more."
"Oh, come on, Al. You mean you can explain all the things that have happened in our house? You mean nothing has happened in there that has scared the hell out of you? Because I don't mind saying I've had the hell scared out of me by quite a few things. I mean, what just happened in there? What was that noise? What shook the windows? What was that?"
Al's lip curled into an angry sneer, and she heard him grind his teeth.
"Look, I don't want to hear this shit, okay? I don't want to hear it. Anything that happens in this house can be explained, you understand me? Don't start sounding like your goddamned crazy son.
Al spun around and left her standing there in the night, alone. She looked up at the window one more time, but saw nothing. Then she followed Al inside. Within the next hour, everyone, one after another, still puzzled and more than a little nervous, decided to go to bed. Carmen went downstairs with Michael and Peter, where, earlier that day, Al had moved Stephen's bed back into Michael's bedroom. She could tell they'd been upset by the explosive sounds, even though they weren't saying anything, and she certainly hoped they hadn't overheard any talk of that green, glowing woman in the window upstairs. That would really scare them. She was afraid they weren't going to want to sleep downstairs. She didn't want that to start again, so she wanted to make them feel as comfortable as possible. Once they were in bed and quietly listening to music,